This is NPR News, and I'm Angela Davis. It is Friday, and Minnesota's federal workers will be without a paycheck again. Today marks the second time they won't get paid. The partial federal government shutdown is impacting thousands of Minnesotans, including some of the most disenfranchised people. About 6,000 federal employees in Minnesota are furloughed or working without pay. Bloomington Immigration Court has had to cancel nearly 1,000 hearings, and Native American tribes are scrambling to operate. Today, we are looking at how the shutdown is hurting Minnesotans and the ramifications if it continues. The man who handles the money that the state gets from the federal government is joining us now. We have Myron Franz, who is the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. He's here in the studio with me right now. Thanks for being here, Commissioner. I know you're busy.
Well, thank you. No, I'm glad to be here. This is really important, and we need to take time to let people know what's going on.
Yeah, you know, as we wait for a compromise to be reached in Washington, D.C. between the president and members of Congress, a lot of damage is being done. You were just here 3 weeks ago, and you said that the longer this goes on, the worse the impact will be. Has that turned out to be true?
It really has, not only from an economic point of view, which we can talk about in terms of how this is affecting the economy and slowing things down, but also in terms of the people that it's affecting and state government. There are three different areas of people that are directly affected, state government and the economy.
Well, first, I want to get to, you know, a developing story that we're just hearing about now. There are widespread flight delays right now at airports on the East Coast because of the shutdown and the impact that it's having on the FAA and the TSA. The FAA is reporting an increase in sick leave. So right now, flights going in and out of LaGuardia Airport in New York City are being restricted because of those staffing issues. Is that something we could see happen here at Minneapolis-St. Paul International?
We certainly could. I mean, one of the things, I mean, Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport is a really very busy airport. And obviously, the ripple effect of this thing could affect other airports. But in addition, there's only so much that these people can take, and some of them are not going to be able to show up. And there's a lot of pressure on the traffic controllers to show up, you know, stint after stint without any support.
And we know our business reporter for NPR, Marty Moreland, he's been out at the airport this morning. He reported right now it looks like things are moving smoothly, and he'll have reports on the airport later today here on NPR. We know the TSA workers out there, they've talked about the hardships that they are dealing with. They are going to work, not getting paid, many of them going to food banks. Or relying on, you know, the help of a lot of businesses in town to get through this. Are you hearing a lot of stories about how these unpaid workers are coping?
There's about 6,000, we think, in Minnesota. And it's really frustrating. Most people just can't imagine living without two paychecks in a row in terms of your mortgage, your child care payments, or your car payments. Now, there are some businesses that have been stepping up, providing food banks, and also U.S. Bank has provided, and other banks are providing a hotline to help people manage their debts, too.
Mm-hmm. And you said there are three areas you want to talk about. So what's the first area that your office is dealing with right now?
It's really the people that we're concerned about. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan attended a public housing event yesterday because we're concerned about Section 8. So at the end of February, the payments to public housing will run out. And so the landlords will no longer be receiving those payments on behalf of Section 8 families. And that's a lot of families in Minnesota that will have housing that may not be available after March 1. And that's a big, big problem. You know, the supplemental nutrition program, the food program, is another thing that's running out at the end of February. And that's like $110 to over 400,000 Minnesotans for food. And that's another problem. So this is really affecting people directly. And we're concerned about that.
Is there any money the state can access to carry us over until the federal government is up again?
Well, that's what we're going to be talking to the legislature about. So right now, we get about $1 billion a month comes into Minnesota from the federal government. About $120 million of that is direct state grants to state agencies. Now, we're behind reimbursement about $6 million after the first month. We think we'll be behind another $6 million every month thereafter. So we can manage that for a while for the state. But what we have to really wonder, do we need to step up in February and take over the SNAP payments, which are $42 million a month? That's where we'd have to have the legislature join us and say, yes, we need to step in and make these payments directly to people.
What about Minnesota businesses? We saw the president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce talking about the shutdown and how it's hurting the economy. He sent a letter to the president and to members of Congress representing Minnesota about it. What are you hearing about businesses?
businesses are really concerned because there's a lot of data that's not available right now. The Department of Commerce is down, so business sales, housing starts, crop sales are down because of the Department of Agriculture. So there's a lot of missing information that's normally available in the economy, and that slows people down. There are a lot of economists that think we're losing maybe 0.1% growth per month in the economy because of this slowdown. And remember, we will be presenting a February forecast on February 28th for the state of Minnesota. So all this negative information, all this slowdown is working right into potentially a negative forecast for Minnesota.
And when you walked in, you told me you have some news about the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. What are you hearing about taxes?
Well, the good news was that they said they're going to open on Monday, January 28th, several weeks ago. But right now we're finding that not all the workers who have been recalled are actually going back because some of them have emergencies where they have to make money. And so they can decide not to go back to work under a shutdown if they have a burdensome situation. So we don't know if all those workers are going to go back. So mainly we're concerned about the delay in refunds. I mean, the system should be up and running on January 28th, both the Department of Revenue in Minnesota and the IRS. But we just don't know in the back office who's going to be there working.
And specifically farmers, what about rural parts of the state? What are you hearing from people in those communities?
Well, they're really concerned because a lot of the farms service agency offices have been closed. Now, they reopened some of them about a week ago, but nonetheless, they can't really close on a lot of USDA loans on mortgages. And so that the information they need for crop planting, that information is being delayed. So there's a lot of disruption to the normal flow. This is when people start getting ready for the spring, believe it or not.
Right. So the impact of this could be far reaching. We may not really know how fully we've been affected for months because of this lost time.
As the governor said yesterday, it's uncharted territory. We just don't know the magnitude, the ripple effect. Now, obviously, if things get going again, some of it will be made up and things will get going pretty quickly. But still, there is going to be some factor of what got delayed and will never be replaced in economic activity.
Well, Commissioner, I want to speak to something very specific. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the hour that tribal leaders are being vocal about how Indian reservations across the state are getting hit hard by all of this. And we reached out to the Red Lake Nation Tribal Health Director to ask him to share with us what he is seeing. And we do have him on the phone right now from Red Lake. We have Orin Bolio joining the conversation. Good morning. How are you, Orin?
Good morning. I'm doing all right. Cold.
Oh, I bet it is cold up there. Tell us, how is Red Lake Nation handling this financial hit?
Well, what we're doing, we're just join together, work together. We meet weekly to determine our cash flow and see what we can do to not close down any services or lay off staff during this time.
So what type of services are being impacted by this loss of government funding right now?
Well, one of the things for Indian healthcare, especially, it's a service called Preferred Contract Services. That's when we see one of our members here on at Red Lake Hospital, and they need additional care. So we send them, say, to Bemidji, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, wherever they need that additional care. And then the federal government usually covers that with this additional dollars. But that's not happening right now. Since government shut down, that is not available. So individuals that need additional care, they're getting letters from the Indian Health Services telling them they're denying services. So we just had, individual, we had a little boy coming here for needing, he sprained his ankle or broke it. So they x-rayed him and told him, well, he said, you're on your own they told his parents that he's on his own until there's additional money available because he wasn't eligible for ME or anything. So, we have cases like that. Last week, they sent 100 letters off to people denying them service for preferred contract care. And this week, they're going to send another 100 out.
What about food? We talked about SNAP, the food stamps program. Are you hearing from families who are concerned that they won't be able to buy enough groceries?
Very concerned about that. We have 16 families that get food through the SNAP's program every month, and they're able to get them in covered for February, but come March 1st, there's 1,600 families that are going to be out of the food that they need to live on.
And I know you're using some of your own money right now, your own funds, to try to cover things till the shutdown ends.
Yes.
But is it getting close to what you'll be able to handle?
We're getting concerned more and more every time we do payroll. We're able to make payroll, but for now, so it's every intention of the tribal council is to keep the people working and keep the services going.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. You are in our thoughts. That is the Red Lake Nation Tribal Health Director, Orin Bolio, joining us on the phone from Red Lake. Myron, you said the governor and lieutenant governor are planning to make some visits to reservations?
Yeah, they're really quite concerned. So on Tuesday, January 29th, the governor and lieutenant governor are going to travel to Du Bois Fort and meet for some nation-to-nation dialogue with several tribal nations to really understand the impact the federal government shutdown on tribal communities. They're going to be visiting a health care center and a Boys and Girls Club that are affected by the shutdown.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. It's a busy time for the Office of Money Management and Budget, but we do have Commissioner Myron Franz here with an update on how the partial government shutdown is affecting Minnesotans. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, from federal government to state politics, this hour we also want to spend some time looking at some of the big issues that are unfolding at the legislature here in Minnesota and St. Paul. This week, we saw state legislators take up the hands-free bill, as well as some other transportation issues. NPR's political reporter Mike Mulcahy is at the Capitol Bureau this morning, and he joins us now to get us up to speed on what is happening there at the Capitol. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Angela. Everybody's warmed up,
I think.
Everybody's here.
Good.
And as you say, if there's one bill that's been on the fast track this first 3 weeks of the legislative session, it is that one that would require drivers to put down their cell phones. It's known as the hands-free requirement, and it's already cleared committees in both the House and the Senate. Just about everybody is predicting it will pass, and that's partly because of the bill's sponsors and the committees that they chair. DFL Representative Frank Hornstein is from Minneapolis. He's the House author of the hands-free bill and chair of the House Transportation and Finance Division. And Republican Senator Scott Newman of Hutchinson chairs the Senate Transportation and Finance Policy. What am I saying? The Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. He also is the author of that hands-free bill in the Senate. And they're both here now at our state capitol office to talk about the hands-free bill and other transportation issues. Thanks to both of you for coming in this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Mike. Very happy to be here.
And Senator Scott Newman, let me start with you. Why is the hands-free bill on the fast track this year after it stalled out last year? What changed, and why does everybody seem to be on board now?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say everybody.
Okay.
But I do think that there has been a slow change in the Minnesota culture when it comes to the hands-free issue. And it's, I believe, being driven by two factors. Number one, the families who have been adversely impacted by drivers not putting their cell phone down, and also by a wide variety of community and business interests who have gotten on board and are now backing the bill. And as a result, you are seeing more and more legislators changing their position. And whereas a year ago, it wasn't, frankly, all that popular of a notion. But today, I'm going to say that I'm pretty hopeful that it is going to get done.
Frank Hornstein, what do you think? Is it just the public changing their minds on this?
I strongly agree with Scott on this. We had hearings last year in both the House and the Senate that were very powerful, very impactful. We haven't had a lot of hearings on this bill in the past. It's been introduced and it's just sort of been left there and not a lot of debate. But once we got this into the public view, and as Scott mentioned, once those families really stepped up, they've been the backbone of support for this bill, tremendous support from the business community and the public at large. I think polling data shows that 80% of Minnesotans support this kind of legislation. So momentum has been on our side. But again, as Scott mentioned, you know, it's the legislature and lots of things pop up here and there. So while we're optimistic, we know there's a lot of work to be done.
Let me just put a call out to our listeners. If you have a question about the hands-free cell phone issue or distracted driving, this is a good time to ask it because these are the two heads of the transportation committees at the state capitol. Give us a call. 651-227-6000 is the number. 651-227-6000. And Scott Newman, you said that there's still some opposition to this. Who's opposed to it and why?
Well, the opposition to it comes from the segment of our society that just feels that they have a right to use their cell phone in a manner that they wish to, and that's to have it in their hand and to not only talk on the phone but also dial the numbers and look up folks that they want to talk to. And my attitude is that this is not a personal freedom issue. This isn't a libertarian issue. This is a public safety issue. And while, by example, I have never voted for a mandatory helmet law. I have never voted for mandatory seatbelt law. If you don't want to comply with those two mandates, that's up to you, in my mind. This is different. You have a responsibility to everybody in your car and everybody on the roadway that you are sharing that road with to be careful. And I think statistically it can be shown very easily that using your cell phone in other than a hands-free manner is dangerous to the public at large.
Is the evidence clear? Because I know there are some studies that show having a conversation on the phone hands-free is just as distracting as having a conversation using your hands. Frank Hornstein, what do you think? Is the evidence clear here?
Well, in states that have passed this law, and there are now 17 plus the District of Columbia, crash rates have gone down significantly. And, of course, that means deaths and injuries have gone down significantly. So we know this kind of legislation works. Now, any distraction is harmful. So people shouldn't be fidgeting with all sorts of gadgets in their car. And even hands-free, as you point out, is not a panacea. It's helpful. And we want to do something that's going to make sure that, our roads are safer. This is a step in the right direction. But really, any distraction is going to be a problem.
Senator Newman, evidence clear?
I just wanted to add to what Frank has just talked about. And part of the problem is not the conversation. It's also the fact that you have the phone in your hand at your ear. And you cut off a good share of your peripheral vision when you do that. And if it's in hands-free mode, that does not occur. And I think that's part of the equation.
Let me ask you about a bill that came up in your committee, Senator, this week that would it was from Senator Dave Osmek. It would increase fines for distracted driving. I think he has fines up to $500 for repeat offenders, and he would even make prison time possible if you're involved in a serious accident and kill somebody when you're distracted. What do you think about that plan, and will the legislature go there, do you think?
Let me answer the question this way, by distinguishing the two bills. The bill that Representative Hornstein and I are bringing forward is a hands-free bill that is proactive. What we are trying to do is get people to put their phone down. The bill that you are talking about with Senator Osmek is a reactive bill, and I don't mean that in a demeaning manner, but it's reactive in that we are going to punish people if they have that phone in their hands and are using it other than hands-free, and you seriously injure or kill someone. And that is the direction that Senator Osmek is coming from. And I will tell you that I personally support Senator Osmek's bill. I don't have any problem whatsoever in punishing people for wrongdoing and the failure to use, that's personal responsibility. And if you're going to drive in that manner and hurt somebody, then you're going to have to suffer the consequences. But the two bills, I really would hope that people can distinguish between the approach, because I'm going to do my best to keep those two bills separate.
Frank Hornstein, what do you think about that? Would you consider that in the House, and does that have a chance to pass, that is increasing penalties aside from the hands-free cell phone?
I strongly agree with Senator Newman on this. This is we are proposing a prevention-oriented approach. I think there's a place for taking a look at a separate bill that increases fines, for example. I think there are also some other good provisions in that bill, which mandates that driver education programs include distracted driving issues so that our new drivers are aware of the dangers. But, you know, this idea of taking away people's phone after several offenses, I don't think that's effective or will really get a lot of traction in the legislature. So there are some elements to that legislation that I think are really good and worth considering. We will have a hearing likely in February on that legislation in the House, similar to what they did in the Senate.
This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy at the State Capitol this morning talking to the chairs of the transportation committees in the House and Senate. Frank Hornstein, you just heard from. He's a DFL representative from Minneapolis, chairs the House committee. And Republican Senator Scott Newman of Hutchinson is here. He chairs the Senate committee. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 651-227-6000. And we have a caller on the line, Brad in Minnetonka. Brad, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me today. I really appreciate it. I am a distracted driver. As a matter of fact, I'm talking to you as I'm driving right now, and I am.
It's not a good idea.
No, it's not. But I'm a danger on the road a lot of the time. Not that I want to put other people in danger, but as a millennial, I think I'm just connected to my phone 100% of the time, and a notification comes up or a call comes in, and I manage it, not really kind of thinking that. If I'm put into a dangerous situation where I may need to make a maneuver or do something on the road, more than likely I'm going to be too distracted to do it. Luckily, I haven't been in that situation yet. And when I've crossed over the lines on the road or accidentally almost missed a stoplight, it just I got lucky. But the fact that there isn't legislation already that says that, you know, we should be a hands-free state, I mean, it's just totally ridiculous. We really should be. People die because of this. I personally know people that have died from distracted driving or have been in an accident from distracted driving. What's the difference between this and drunk driving? I mean, you have a couple drinks and all of a sudden you can't operate the vehicle safely. And that's the bottom line.
All right. Well, let me run that by the guest, but put the phone down and just drive if you're driving. Frank Hornstein, I don't know if the caller was serious, but this is the kind of behavior I think a lot of us see all the time, people talking on their phones while they're driving. Would this law actually change people's behavior, or would it just give the police another reason to pull somebody like that over?
Well, once something is in law, I think that there is a strong message sent to the public. And again, the proof is in the reduction in the crash statistics that we've seen in most other states that have adopted this. So, again, the data is clear. This actually helps, and it also helps to enforce the texting ban that we have enacted in the state. And so the data is very clear, and so we know that lives will be saved with this kind of legislation.
And Senator Newman, I'll give you a quick chance to respond to that.
Representative Hornstein is correct. The bill that we are proposing will change people's behavior because there really are a lot of good people in Minnesota that do want to obey the law. And they will put their phone down once we make it illegal for them to have it in their hand. As far as enforcement is concerned, law enforcement in no uncertain terms have told us that they believe this hands-free bill will help them in the enforcement of the texting, because when they pull somebody over that they believe to be texting, then a roadside argument ensues as to whether, no, I'm not texting, I was dialing a number on my phone. So it will help law enforcement in getting people to put the phone down.
Let's go right back to a caller. Patricia is on the line from Stacy. Hi, Patricia, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. The last few near misses that I had in my car driving, the other driver was obviously on the phone with it to their ear, and I had to take evasive action to avoid an accident, like at an intersection or whatever. Mm-hmm. And my question is, Is there a part of this bill that includes like some kind of high visibility educational piece that drives home to other drivers how dangerous this is to other people? I don't want to lose my life or limb or whatever because somebody else just had to talk to somebody about nothing.
Hmm. Okay. Senator Scott Newman?
Currently, there is no such provision in the bill. However, it's an excellent idea. The educational piece is contained in the other bill that is moving through the legislature. That would be the OSMIC bill. And in that bill, and that's the one that increases penalties, that has a provision in it that would provide for education during the driver's training episodes that folks go through. Patricia, your suggestion is absolutely appropriate and a very good one.
All right, let's take another caller. Tom is on the line from Dresser, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say thank you very much for promoting this bill. I think this is something that's long overdue, and I drive basically for a living in sales, and I see a lot of issues with people on the road. Especially when they're texting, it's almost amplified when it goes just from the phone in the hand to actually texting and staring at the screen. And to the point earlier made, I think it'll help a lot with enforcement. Once that phone is in the hand, then it's just obvious that they can get an infraction for it. I do utilize my phone when I drive, but it's only hands-free, and it's only when the situation is clear that I can, you know, be on the freeway and I'm not causing anybody any issues at that particular time.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Frank Hornstein, do you need a special new phone to do this? Are most phones, they have the hands-free capability?
Well, thanks, Tom, also for your support. We have lots of options here. People can use the Bluetooth. A lot of this is already in the newer models. The hands-free mode is a part of the automobile. People can buy converters fairly cheaply. So we feel that the population as a whole really does have access to this technology. That's really not a problem.
Okay. Since we have a couple callers on the air, let's just keep going for a little while, and then I'll change the subject in a few minutes. John from Minneapolis. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, I'm curious if you guys have talked about the impact of that bill on rideshare drivers, since all the communication comes through an app on the phone. And just as a side note to that previous caller, there is an app that you can get through Sprint, at least for younger drivers, that makes the phone shut off if the phone is moving like in a vehicle. So there are other technologies besides just Bluetooth and hands-free type stuff. But I'm curious what you guys plan on, have you talked about rideshare drivers?
So this is like Lyft or Uber
Correct. Drivers,
yeah. So what would happen,
well,
Frank?
Well, if the phone is affixed to the dashboard, as it often is in these situations, that's considered hands-free.
Okay, so it wouldn't have much of an impact.
I don't believe it would, but John brings up a really interesting point as to why it is so difficult to write a bill like this, and that is simply technology is changing so fast that it's hard to write a bill that anticipates all of the different changes in technology, not only the devices, but the apps that will run on these devices, and it really makes it very difficult to write, for instance, a true distracted driving bill. I tried that a year ago, and I really couldn't get it to work because of the ambiguity of the various legal definitions on distracted driving.
So is it not against the law to be distracted and drive now?
Yes, it is. The problem always is to what degree and how do you prove it? And it's the enforcement that we are after. In other words, we pass if Representative Hornstein and I can get a law passed that requires people to put that phone down, there's still going to be distractions in that automobile, and there always has been. But what we will have done is to nail down the most egregious of the distracted driving. And if we tackle texting and hands-free phone operation, we will have covered the vast majority of the problems.
All right. Let's take another caller, Tom from Minneapolis.
Hi. I'm a bicyclist and don't have a car. But one of the things I observe at intersections, and yes, I do stop for stoplights and stop signs, is the number of people who immediately whip out their phone and start texting or doing something on it. And two things, an observation and a question. The observation is that oftentimes they'll be distracted enough that they won't see the light change and somebody behind them will honk and then they will bolt forward. And oftentimes when they're turning right, they'll turn right in front of me. I have to be aware of it. Is there any provision that if you're at an intersection, this is not applicable, or if you're stopped, you're not applicable, or is it only when you're moving? How does that work?
Tom, let's get to that in 1 minute, but let me ask you a question. Do you ride your bike when it's this cold?
Yeah, I just rode out to Eden Prairie from Minneapolis this morning and then came back. So, yeah, I do.
Wow. Okay. You win at some kind of award today. Representative Hornstein.
We lost him. Tom, thank you for your question, and it's a good one. This does apply to people in traffic. So if you're at a stop sign and a red light, this affects you for the very reason that you said. Oftentimes people say, well, I'm at a red light. There's no problems. There are things coming at you. You're in traffic. You have to be attentive when you're behind the wheel all the time. And so, yes, if you are at a stop sign, if you're at a red light, this does apply. Now, you can get off the road, get off the street, get into a parking lot, make your call then. That's safer. But this would apply to the situation that Tom is referring to.
So it's whenever the car is running.
Correct.
Can't have your hands on that cell phone.
Yep. In traffic.
Okay. Catherine from Minneapolis.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking
Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions on the provisions of this bill. First of all, when an officer stops a driver because of this violation, is this going to be a primary offense so that the officer can stop a driver only for that? I remember about the seatbelt requirement. That was a secondary offense. They had to be stopped for some other problem. And the other question I had was, for a violation of this law, what is it, a misdemeanor, a felony? Have the legislators considered that part of it? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Scott Newman.
Catherine, thank you for your question. They are excellent. This would be a primary offense, and the law enforcement would be able to stop for that offense only. And the violation is currently defined as a petty misdemeanor, which is a $50 fine for the first offense, $250 fine for the second offense. By definition, a petty misdemeanor is not a crime. Representative Hornstein and I have agreed that we are going to do our very best to keep the penalty phase the same as it is for texting right now. And we are doing that for the simple reason that we are pursuing this bill from a proactive standpoint. What we are trying to do is get people to put their phone down. We are not trying to create criminals out of people who are driving.
So it's not a crime, but does it get reported to your insurance company? Would it make your insurance rate go up?
Conceivably, Mike, it could, yes.
Okay. Let me, as long as I have you both here, and transportation is such a big issue, and we're going to hear a lot of other things debated as the session goes on, let me ask you a few other questions, and I wondered if we could start with the MNLARS system, which is drawn a lot of ire from a lot of people. It's the online licensing and registration system. It's had all kinds of problems when they tried to replace it and bring in a new system. It's already cost the taxpayers, I think, more than $100 million. Is the situation getting any better? That's the first question. Frank Hornstein, what do you think?
Well, we are going on 11 years of problems with this. I think there have been some steps forward, but there have been also some very ongoing problems that continue to exist, that our constituents are having long delays in terms of getting their driver's license, getting their license tabs. There have been technology glitches. So we have in statute a bipartisan commission that's been set up, and Senator Newman and I chair that this year. And we are going to be looking into this issue with the new administration. It's got to be fixed. This is a basic function that the government needs to perform. And it is needed. I mean, we do have to have a new system for driver's license and registration and license tabs, et cetera. But, you know, the rollout has been problematic. There have been glitches from the start. And this goes back to 2008 and then the Pawlenty administration. So it's been a bipartisan problem, I would say.
And, Senator, you have, I know, called for a private contractor to come in and take it over. Are you still in favor of that?
The answer to that question is absolutely I'm in favor of it. And by that, I'm not suggesting that a private contractor is the only way to go. But what I am suggesting is that we should have a request for a proposal from the two private businesses that did respond to our inquiry, both of whom have said they could do this. And I see absolutely no reason why we shouldn't entertain that idea to see whether or not it would be better to go with a private company versus a state agency. And this Minlar's problem is easily the most frustrating issue that I have handled in my legislative career.
And why is that?
Because they won't fix it. Now, they rolled this out, and Frank is right. This has been going on for a decade. Mm-hmm. They're far, far, far over budget. But they rolled this thing out a year and a half ago, and they are still unable to make it function properly. So I would encourage folks to tune in long about the middle of February. We've got a legislative auditor's report is going to come out. We will be getting budget requests at about that time. That's about the time that I would anticipate Representative Hornstein and I are going to call this Minlar Steering Committee back in. It's also when they are going to have their next rollout is in February, which DPS maintains they're going to have this thing fixed. So right after those three events occur, I think Representative Hornstein and I are going to bring this committee in and we're going to see how they're doing.
What do you expect the legislative auditor report to show? Will people lose their jobs because of this? What do you think, Representative Hornstein?
Well, in the past, the legislative auditor has done a good job of identifying what some of the problems have been. One thing that they uncovered was that the someone who owned a Ford F-50, 150 paid $2 for his or her fee, and then someone else who had a much smaller vehicle paid in the hundreds. And, you know, it's those sorts of inconsistencies that we rely on the auditor to expose. So, you know, they've done a good job of identifying the problems. That's what the nonpartisan legislative auditor is there for. And so, if there are some issues, they will uncover those and they will make recommendations to the legislature about how to remedy them.
Senator, you think heads will roll?
Way, way, way out of my department. I have no ability to make a determination on that. But I would urge you to tune into the legislative auditor's report when it does come out. I don't know what it's going to say, but it's for me, it's going to be some pretty interesting reading. And I have been told by Mr. Nobles that it will be out in February.
Hmm. Mike, and I just wanted to add, I mean, we are in a very competitive environment to get top-rate IT professionals to work for the state of Minnesota. And so we need to make sure that we are staffing these agencies properly, and that we have really good, qualified, top-flight people that are willing to, you know, have a public career. And so we, at the same time we hold these agencies accountable, we also want to make sure they have the resources to get the job done. And so we'll be looking at that, and I hope the legislative auditor looks at that as well.
Well, the governor has been unable so far, apparently, to hire a director or a commissioner of IT services.
That's the point. I mean, we need to be creating opportunities and work environments for talented people. And so we have to staff these things adequately, and we also we have to give the resources, but we also have to make sure that our systems are running as well. And we're looking at mid-February together as a time to take a look at this because, you know, we have a new administration, so we're turning the page, and we're hopeful that we can work cooperatively with the new administration, the new Department of Public Safety Commissioner, who is a former colleague of ours, John Harrington, a very good person, and hopefully a new IT commissioner soon. And we'll have a new team to work with, and I think that's helpful and hopeful.
Presumably.
And if I may, Mike, I just want to echo Frank's sentiments. It's a new administration. We have a new governor. We have new commissioners coming in. And I am very, very hopeful that we can work collaboratively together and get this fixed.
Presumably, though, they're going to ask for more money, right? I mean, if it's still not working, they're going to need more money.
I would anticipate that there will be a request for additional funds from Minit, which is the IT, additional funds from DPS, who owns or has the system. We are going to get a request for money from deputy registrars, the auto dealers. The towing industry is now coming in and with a fee adjustment request. I anticipate that there will be a fee increase request by deputy registrars. There's a lot of different directions that people are going to be coming at us with requests for funding. For my part, what I want to see is all of those funding requests on the table at the same time so I can look at them globally rather than one at a time.
Representative?
I agree, but I think we are coming up to some deadlines in terms of adequate staffing and adequate resources for particularly the Minit part of this, the IT part. And, the DPS has said consistently that, we have wait times for people who have questions about this. And, of course, people have questions because the technology isn't working. So we have to make sure that they have the resources so that people aren't on hold for a long time. So I'm concerned about the staffing and the staffing levels. And we definitely have to reimburse these deputy registrars, but exactly how much and how we do that, that's an open question. So there's a lot to do and a lot to fix here.
Well, and hands-free, MNLARS, those probably aren't even the biggest debate of the session when it comes to transportation.
Well, I do want to say that, Senator Newman and I have an excellent working relationship. We were colleagues together in the House. We have met. We continue to meet regularly. It's our intention to move forward on things that we agree on and have a common framework. And there'll be some things later in the session, perhaps, that we don't agree on. But we've established an excellent working relationship. And I think that's what the people of Minnesota want. They want their elected officials from each party to be working collaboratively. And I'm really pleased with our level of collaboration so far. So we've identified MNLARS, hands-free, maybe passing a bill that has some of the provisions that were vetoed last year, something we want to get done early this session.
Well, let's put that bipartisanship and cooperation to the test a little bit, because Governor Walz has made it pretty clear he wants to raise the gas tax to pay for roads and bridges. And is that going to pass in the House first?
Well, that is going to be something we do disagree on. We are going to be looking at the proposal that Governor Walz puts together. His budget is going to come out on February 19th. I personally think, and there's many people on our side of the aisle that feel that there needs to be new revenue to fix our crumbling infrastructure. We cannot keep going on the way we're going on without a significant infusion of revenue. The American Society of Civil Engineers has rated our infrastructure a D+. That's hardly comforting. And we want to make sure that every part of the state is covered: roads, bridges, public transportation systems, urban, suburban, rural. So it's a challenge. It's a funding challenge. And we'll be coming forward with the Walz administration with a funding proposal.
Senator, what about it? Gas tax increase for transportation?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Representative Hornstein and I are not going to be in agreement on that. But I frankly, I think that's okay. We do have that good working relationship, and we are going to work in a bipartisan manner as best that we can. And the one thing I can promise everybody is that it is going to be civil and courteous. But we're not going to agree on everything. As to whether or not we wind up with an increase in a gas tax this year, without question, I will oppose it. But that doesn't mean that it isn't going to happen. There's a whole lot of other players involved here. So I guess we just have to put that question on hold for now. Both Representative Hornstein and I will bring you up to date at a later date when we actually get into that those conversations, mm-hmm. which to date we have not.
Well, would you give the issue a hearing?
An increase of the gas tax?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it is likely at least your committee would vote on it?
Yes. No promises as to what the outcome of the vote would be.
Are there people in your caucus, do you think, who would vote for it?
I don't know. I just don't know. I would answer that question if I can, but it's just a question I do not know the answer to.
And what is the problem with the gas tax? Because, I think I came in today and it looked like gas was at about $2.10. It was as low as, I think, $2 back on Christmas. It's been much higher than that. If you put a nickel or a dime on that, would people even notice after a while?
From my standpoint, my answer is this. Minnesota, and nobody is going to be surprised by this part of my answer. Minnesota is the fifth highest tax state in the nation. I am not interested in leveling another tax on them. But in addition to that, I think the gas tax is outmoded and outdated and is going to be obsolete because eventually we are going to have all electric cars on the road, and now the gas tax becomes obsolete. No question we have to find a new funding source. But I think everybody, whether you drive a car or not, benefits from a good transportation system. Everybody eats, everybody wears clothes, etc. So I think the funding source for the additional infrastructure should come out of the general fund.
And Representative Hornstein, what's wrong with that argument? I mean, the state seems to have a surplus now, and there seems to be a lot of money around.
Well, I think I would take issue with that. We have a surplus, but once we look at the budget reserves, once we fund the real core functions of what the general fund provides, which is education and healthcare, there's just not a lot left. And we shouldn't be taking away from education and healthcare to fund roads. That's number one. Number two, we have the amount of money that has been taken from the general fund, and I do say taken, has been just not even close to adequate to getting to the need that we have. It's over $600 million a year. So if we're going to finish projects like Highway 14 or I-94 heading northwest of the cities, I mean, there's a whole long list. Every transportation financier knows the list of highway projects. This is constitutionally dedicated money. So the users, the people that use the system, are the ones that are paying for it. I think that's very fair. It's guaranteed in our Constitution. So the gas tax doesn't go for trains in the metro area or any other function. It goes for roads and bridges only. So we need this. It's going to be a while before we get to all electric vehicles. So we need this, and we need it now, and it's urgent.
Well, to be continued. We'll see how this goes. Thank you both, though, for coming by. It's been a very interesting hour, and it just flew by. Frank Hornstein, he's a DFL representative from Minneapolis. Scott Newman, he's a Republican senator from Hutchinson. They chair the transportation committees in the House and Senate, and thanks so much for coming by again.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And Angela Davis, let's go back to you downtown. Are you still
there?
Yes,
I'm still there. And for the record, Mike, you can hijack the show anytime. As long as you help us get a better understanding of what is going on there at the state capitol, we do appreciate it. Tell us, what do you think is on tap for next week? I mean, we saw all the discussions about the hands-free bill take a lot of time this week. What about next week?
A lot of big issues coming up next week. There's going to be talk about elder abuse. There's going to be talk about sexual assault, talk about that money to make the voting system safe from hacking, and proposals to make it easier to register people to vote. So hearings on all of that. Also, there's a bill that was just introduced that'll get a hearing next week to provide state-backed loans, no-interest loans, to federal employees who aren't being paid because of the shutdown. So we'll pay attention to that, too, next week.
Yeah, it's all good stuff, all interesting. I'm particularly interested in elder abuse, seeing some progress with that. Thank you, Mike Mulcahy, NPR's political editor, joining us from our Capitol Bureau this morning.